Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. What we have been doing for some months now is exploring the myths about money. Our money system is not what we have been led to believe. The creation of money has been privatized or taken over by a private money cartel. Except for coins, all of our money is now created as loans advanced by private banking institutions, including the private Federal Reserve. Banks create the principal, but not the interest, to service their loans. To find the interest, new loans must continually be taken out, expanding the money supply, inflating prices, and robbing you of the value of your money. We've been specifically looking at a book called The Web of Debt, which unravels the deception and presents a clear picture of the financial abyss towards which we are heading. It then explores workable alternatives, particularly one that was tested in colonial America and is grounded in the best of American economic thought, including the writings of Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln. It helps us to analyze and improve our own financial security, personally and nationally, and to deeply understand the cause of the problems we are personally experiencing financially. At the onset, I give an important credit because the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this program are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of attorney, scholar, and author Ellen Brown, who has 11 books and scores of articles on debt-related matters. I highly recommend her book, The Web of Debt. You should also visit her website by the same name. You could also go to www.kruufm.com under Archives to listen to all of the shows produced on this and other debt-related topics. This particular series is under Life and Debt Web. During the last show, I ended talking about India, a country of many states and disparities. Indian states, where globalist free trade policies have been imposed, workers have been reduced to sweatshop conditions due to murderous competition between workers without union protection. This is basically the vast majority of the states in India. However, there are a few which have excelled tremendously, and it turns out that this is due to the way their economies were set up, what is known as the socialist welfare model. These are the states that the major corporations like Microsoft and Oracle are finding highly skilled computer talent. From the London Observer, it was quoted, "The computer wizards of Bangalore and Kerala are the products of fully funded state education systems where, unlike the USA, no child is left behind. A huge apparatus of state-owned or state-controlled industries, redistributionist tax systems, subsidies of necessities from electricity to food, tight government regulation, and affirmative action programs for the lower castes are what has created those comfortable refuges for Oracle and Microsoft. What has made all this possible was not capitalist competitive drive, as there was no corporate entrepreneur in sight, but the state's investment in universal education and the village's commitment to development of opportunity, not for a lucky few, but for the entire community. The village was 100% literate, 100% unionized, and 100% committed to sharing resources through a sophisticated credit union finance system. And that was from the London Observer. However, the conditions are much different in most of the other states, like Andhra Pradesh, where farming has been the target of a poverty eradication program of the British government. Andhra Pradesh has the highest number of farmer suicides in India. These tragedies have generally followed the amassing of unrepayable debts for expensive seeds and chemicals for export crops that did not produce the promised returns. A report was put out that the number of farmer suicides between 1997 and 2005 is 150,000. India's farmers make up 70% of the population, and they voted out the existing coalition government in May 2004, but the new ruling party, the United Progressive Alliance, UPA, has also had to take its marching orders from the World Bank, the World Trade Organization, and multinational corporations. The Sustainable Economics Journal published an article that had noted that laws and policies have been pushed through the legislature and threatened to rob the poor of their seeds, their food, their health, and their livelihoods, including, one, a new patent ordinance that introduces product patents on seeds and medicines, putting them beyond people's reach. Prices increase 10 to 100-fold under patent monopolies. Since India is also the source of low-cost generic medicines for Africa, the introduction of patent monopolies in India is likely to increase debt and poverty globally. Two, new policies for water privatization have been introduced, including privatization of Delhi's water supply, pushing water tariffs up by 10 to 15 times. The policies threaten to deprive the poor of their fundamental right to water, diverting scarce incomes to pay water bills that are 10 times higher than needed to cover the cost of operations and maintenance. And third, the removal of regulations on prices and volumes, allowing giant corporations to set up private markets, destroying local markets and local production. India produces thousands of crops on millions of farms, while agribusiness trades in only a handful of commodities. Their new central role in much less regulated Indian markets is likely to result in destruction of diversity and displacement of small producers and traders. Turns out that India's poor have not taken all of this lying down. Following Gandhi's example of mass non-cooperation with oppressive British laws, they organized a nationwide movement against the patent ordinance. Communities created freedom zones to protect themselves from corporate invasion in areas such as genetically modified seeds, pesticides, unfair contracts, and monopolistic markets. I'll be back to this issue in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM. The voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. A key factor in the protracted crisis in Indian agriculture has been the drying up of credit since the 1990s, particularly for owners of small farms and businesses. After India's nationalization in 1969, banks extended credit to many sections of the population that were formerly considered unbankable, particularly farmers and small business owners. But by 2007, 90% of farmers still remained outside the bank network, and for those farmers and small businessmen who could get credit, interest rates were about double those for large-scale industries. Again, this was largely due to policies imposed from abroad. A major factor contributing to the decline in bank credit to the small business sector was the Basel norm imposed on commercial banks in the 1980s by the Bank for International Settlements, the BIS, the central bankers' bank in Basel, Switzerland. The BIS set capital adequacy standards under which loans to private borrowers are risk-weighted with the degree of risk determined by private rating agencies. Since small businesses cannot afford the agency's fees, banks assign 100% risk to the loans. The banks then resist extending credit to these high-risk borrowers because more capital is required to cover the loans. When the conscience of the nation was aroused by a spate of suicides among Indian farmers, the UPA government, lamenting the neglect of farmers by commercial banks, established a policy of ending the financial exclusion of the weak. But this step had little real effect on lending practices, due partly to the strictures imposed from abroad. The reform agenda calling for free trade and privatization has made significant inroads since the early 1990s, with neoliberals routinely decrying the fact that India's public sector banks are oriented more towards serving the customer than turning a profit. But studies showed that Indian public sector banks were outperforming private sector banks even before the current credit crisis, which has hit the most aggressive private international banks particularly hard. Customers are now fleeing to the safety of India's public sector banks, which have emerged largely unscathed through the credit debacle. The public sector banks have been credited with keeping the country's financial industry robust at a time when the U.S. market is experiencing its worst financial crisis since the 1930s. India's state-led, populist-oriented democratic model may yet have a chance to prove that service to the public is not incompatible with efficiency, profitability, and growth. India's grassroots movement against invasion by Western-style corporate interests has called for a rethinking of GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which led to the creation of the World Trade Organization in 1995. The WTO requires the laws of every member to conform to its own and has the power to enforce the compliance by imposing sanctions. The United States is also a member of the WTO. Critics warn that Americans could soon be seeing international troops in their own streets. The New World Order, NWO, that was heralded at the end of the Cold War was supposed to be a harmonious global village without restrictions on trade and with cooperative policing of drug trafficking, terrorism, and arms controls. But to the wary, it is the road to a one-world government headed by transnational corporations, oppressing the public through military means and restricting individual freedoms. Bob Georgievic, writing in the paleoconservative journal Chronicles in 1998, compared the NWO to the old British Empire. Quote, "Parallels between the British Empire and the New World Order Empire are striking. It's just that the British Crown relied on brute force to achieve its objectives, while the NWO elite mostly used financial terrorism. The British Empire was built by colonizing other countries, seizing their natural resources, and shipping them to England to feed the British industrialists' factories. In wake of the Redcoats' invasions, local cultures were often trampled and replaced by a more progressive British way of life." And of course, more progressive is in quotes. "The Wall Street-dominated NWO empire is being built by colonizing other countries with foreign loans or investments. When the fish is firmly on the hook, the NWO financial terrorists pull the plug, leaving the unsuspecting victim high and dry and begging to be rescued. In comes the International Monetary Fund, its bailout recipes, privatization, trade liberalization, and other austerity reforms amount to seizing the target country's natural and other resources and turning them over to the NWO elites just as surely as the British Empire did by using cruder methods." End quote. Americans tend to identify with these Wall Street banks and transnational corporations because they have U.S. addresses, but Georgievic warns that the international cartels do not necessarily have our best interests in mind. To the contrary, Main Street America appears to be their next targeted takeover. So let's move ahead then to the next section, the debt spider that captures America. And going back to the wonderful Wizard of Oz, quote, "We are all threatened," answered the tiger, "by a fierce enemy which has lately come into this forest. It is a most tremendous monster, like a great spider, with a body as big as an elephant and legs as long as a tree trunk. As the monster crawls through the forest, he seizes an animal with a leg and drags it to his mouth, where he eats it as a spider does a fly. Not one of us is safe while this fierce creature is alive." End of quote. Now, specifically with another example from The Wizard of Oz, breaking the back of the Tin Man, which is debt serfdom for American workers. The Tin Man said in The Wizard of Oz, "I worked harder than ever, but I little knew how cruel my enemy could be. She made my axe slip again so that it cut right through my body." Now, over to the United States. The mighty United States has been in the banking spider's sights for more than 2 centuries, believe it or not. It too has been captured in the spider's web, choked in debt spun out of thin air. Today, the United States has surpassed even third world countries in its debt level. By 2004, the debt of the U.S. government had hit $7.6 trillion, more than 3 times that of all third world countries combined. As of today, the U.S. national debt is $14.8 trillion. In other words, twice the debt from 2004. Like the bankrupt consumer who stays afloat by making the minimum payment on his credit card, the U.S. government has avoided bankruptcy by paying just the interest on its monster debt. But even that mounting bill could soon be more than the government can afford to pay. So long as the debt is in U.S. dollars, the government can just print its way out of insolvency. But if the dollar loses its status as global reserve currency, and the U.S. winds up in debt in some other currency, it could well find itself on the road to actual bankruptcy. Al Martin is a retired naval intelligence officer, former contributor to the Presidential Council of Economic Advisors, and author of a weekly newsletter called Behind the Scenes in the Beltway. In an April 2005 newsletter, he noted that the ratio of total U.S. debt, public and private, to gross domestic product, GDP, had risen to 308% in April 2005. Now, the International Monetary Fund considers a nation-state with a total debt-to-GDP ratio of 200% or more to be a deconstructed third-world nation-state. Martin wrote, quote, "What deconstructed actually means is that a political regime in that country or series of political regimes have, through a long period of fraud, abuse, graft, corruption, and mismanagement, effectively collapsed the economy of that country," end quote. Other commentators warn that the shock therapy tested in third world countries was the next step planned for the United States, and we'll get back to this in a moment. If you are just tuning in, this is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So back to shock therapy. Editorialist Mike Whitney wrote in Counterpunch in April 2005, quote, "The towering national debt, coupled with the staggering trade deficits, have put the nation on a precipice, and a seismic shift in the fortunes of middle-class Americans is looking more likely all the time. The country has been intentionally plundered and will eventually wind up in the hands of its creditors. This same Ponzi scheme has been carried out repeatedly by the IMF and World Bank throughout the world. Bankruptcy is a fairly straightforward way of delivering valuable public assets and resources to collaborative industries and of annihilating national sovereignty. After a nation is successfully driven to destitution, public policy decisions are made by creditors and not by representatives of the people. The catastrophe that middle-class Americans face is what these elites breezily refer to as shock therapy, a sudden jolt followed by fundamental changes in the system. In the near future, we can expect tax reform, fiscal discipline, deregulation, free capital flows, lower tariffs, reduced public services, and privatization, end quote. Catherine Austin Fitz was formerly the managing director of a Wall Street investment bank and was assistant secretary of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, HUD, under President George Bush Sr. She called what was happening to the economy a criminal leveraged buyout of America, something she defined as buying a country for cheap with its own money and then jacking up the rents and fees to steal the rest. She called it the American tapeworm model. Quote, "The American tapeworm model is to simply finance the federal deficit through warfare, currency exports, treasury and federal credit borrowing, and cutbacks in domestic discretionary spending. This will then place local municipalities and local leadership in a highly vulnerable position, one that will allow them to be persuaded with bogus but high-minded sounding arguments to further cut resources. Then, to preserve bond ratings and the rights of creditors, our leaders will be persuaded to sell out our water, natural resources, and infrastructure assets at significant discounts of their true value to global investors. This will all be described as a plan to save America by recapitalizing it on a sound financial footing. In fact, this process will simply shift more capital continuously from America to other continents and from the lower and middle classes to elites." End quote. In 1894, Jacob Coxey warned of the destruction of the great American middle class. That prediction, unfortunately, is rapidly materializing as the gap between rich and poor grows ever wider. The Federal Reserve reported in 2004 that the wealthiest 1% of Americans held 33.4% of the nation's wealth, up from 30.1% in 1989, while the top 5% held 55.5% of the wealth. The poorest 50% of the population held only 2.5% of the wealth, down from 3% in 1989. The very wealthiest 1% of Americans owned a bigger piece of the pie, 33.4%, than the poorest 90%, 30.4% of the pie. They also owned 62.3% of the nation's business assets. And finally, the wealthiest 5% owned 93.7% of the value of bonds, 71.7% of non-residential real estate, and 79.1% of the nation's stock. Forbes magazine reported that from 1997 to 1999, the wealth of the 400 richest Americans grew by an average of $940 million each for a daily increase of $1.3 million per person. Note that lists of this sort do not include the world's truly richest families, including the Rothschilds, the Warburgs, and a long list of royal families. Whether they consider it to be in bad taste or because they fear retribution from the bottom of the wealth pyramid, the super elite do not make their fortunes public. While the super rich were amassing fortunes rivaling the economies of small countries, Americans in the lower brackets are struggling with food and medical bills. Personal bankruptcy filings more than doubled from 1995 to 2005 when the bankruptcy code was revised. In 2004, more than 1.1 million consumers filed for bankruptcy under Chapter 7. A Chapter 7 bankruptcy stays on the debtor's credit record for 10 years from the date of filing, but at least it wipes the slate clean. In 2005, the law was changed, making it more costly and cumbersome for consumers to file bankruptcy, trying to push more people into the traditional Chapter 13 payback plan kind of bankruptcy. That particular law was the result of almost a decade of lobbying from the credit industry, and it does provide some benefits now to creditors that it did not allow before. However, bankruptcy attorneys have worked very diligently in the last 6 years to correct the bulk of the aggression the law had on debtors. Homestead exemptions have traditionally protected homes from foreclosure and bankruptcy, but not all states have these kinds of protections, and the statutes usually preserve only a fraction of the home's worth. Those of us who live in Iowa are fortunate because the homestead exemption, that means the equity in the home, is not only protected, but it is and can be unlimited in amount, except for protecting against debt that preceded the homestead and was never paid down. So I was in a special category. It also happens in many states that the homeowner could not just lose his home, but could owe a deficiency or a balance due for whatever the creditor bank failed to get from a resale after a foreclosure. The creditor then can go after the former owner for the balance of that loan, that deficiency. Bankruptcy, of course, would get rid of that. And in some states, like Iowa, there are anti-deficiency laws which actually prevent this and are generally followed. This allows the purchaser to walk away without paying the balance owed, even without filing bankruptcy. But it should be noted that not all states have these anti-deficiency laws and that they only apply to the original mortgage on the home. If the buyer takes out a second mortgage or takes equity out of the home, anti-deficiency laws generally do not apply. Plus, there has been, in the last several decades, a push to persuade homeowners to take out home equity loans, which is reminiscent of the 1920s campaign to persuade people to borrow against their homes to invest in the stock market. When the stock market crashed in the 20s, their homes became the property of the banks. Today, elderly people burdened with medical and drug bills are particularly susceptible to those tactics, and a massive advertising campaign has happened in the last several decades to get people feeling comfortable to use the equity in their homes for a variety of credit situations, such as student loans, vacations, and credit card payoffs. This is a sleight of hand to get unsecured debt transferred to secure debt against the home, which can result and often does result in people losing their homes for not being able to pay some debt that should have ultimately been an unsecured debt and dischargeable in bankruptcy. And I will continue with this discussion in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.